Hello, and thanks for joining us for this latest episode of Education in Focus South Asia, a series of podcasts focusing on areas of debate in education in the South Asia region, brought to you by the British Council. My name's Rob Lewis, and later on, you'll be hearing my co-presenter, Simon Ball. English medium instruction, or EMI as it's often called, is very much a big issue today. With English as the language of global business, education and more, it's no surprise that there are pressures for countries to improve the capacity of their school and university learners in English. Providing instruction of other subjects through the medium of English would, seemingly, be the perfect solution. But is that really the case? Later on, you'll hear Simon speaking to Professor Ernesto Macro of the University of Oxford and Professor Kathleen Hugh of the University of South Australia. To begin, though, I spoke to Professor Janine Treffers-Daller of the University of Reading, who has a particular interest in multilingualism. I spoke to Janine about that context. Janine started by giving some background on what's driving English medium instruction, or EMI, currently.
Many parents feel that it's very important for their children to learn English as soon as possible, because they see English as a language of power and a gateway to improving one's socioeconomic position. So there's a lot of parental pressure to introduce English as early as grade 3 or even at grade 1, and to use English as the medium of instruction. So in India, you have private schools not only for the elite, so these are very expensive private schools, but there are also low-cost private schools, and these are more accessible for people with modest salaries. And these schools attract a lot of children out of the state school system because they promise a curriculum that is taught through the medium of English.
Okay, so the parents are pushing this move to have this English language education for their children.
The parents are voting with their feet, as it were, as they believe that you need to start with English as early as possible. But the research evidence is not there to back this up. An additional problem is that certainly in the low-cost private schools, the competency of the teachers in English is relatively low. So the demand on the teacher to deliver a classroom through the medium of English is too difficult for the teacher. They cannot deliver that, and they don't get sufficient training during their teacher training in how to deliver English medium education. So what happens in those classrooms is actually that maybe the textbooks are in English and some key terminology is in English, but the explanations take place in the local language.
Right, so that's not an encouraging description, but even if classes aren't as parents imagine, even if there's just some English input, doesn't it help?
So just speaking English in the classroom is not going to work that well for the majority of classrooms where children have a very limited knowledge of the target language and teachers also have low levels of English competency.
Okay, now you mentioned parental pressure to start really early, even at grade one. Is that actually one solution to improving levels of English, to start English medium classes as early as possible in a child's education?
It's probably not by starting extremely early, say in preschool or even in the first year of primary school, but to delay it a little bit until children have a good, strong foundation of learning in their first language or in their different mother tongues, and that at a later stage, maybe from the third grade onwards, some English is being introduced, but not necessarily as the medium of instruction, but actually as a subject that is being taught alongside other subjects. Unfortunately, there is not a lot of evidence available yet. We would like to be able to say, if you want to learn through the medium of English, you need to know at least, say, 3,000, 4,000 words of English, or you need to have the following basic grammar rules in place. But unfortunately, we haven't got any such evidence at the moment. My colleague, Professor Ianthi Zimpli from the University of Cambridge, and colleagues from the University of Reading, including myself, have started a project funded by the Economics and Social Research Council and the Department for International Development, which looks at multilingualism and multiliteracy in primary schools in India. And we want to find out to what extent using the children's mother tongues in school is helpful for learning and is helpful for cognitive development. So what we aim to find out is, does it actually help to throw children into English at a very early age, Or is it actually better to start English later and learn English as a subject from, say, the third grade? Our idea is that the medium of instruction should reflect the strength of the child. When it does, that child will learn better.
Janine's comments on her experiences and findings in India are quite revealing, and the findings from the research she mentioned are certainly eagerly awaited. EMI, though, of course, reaches beyond primary and secondary age, and in many countries is most closely associated with higher education. To get a broader global overview of EMI, Simon spoke to Professor Ernesto Macro. Ernesto is Emeritus Professor of Applied Linguistics at the University of Oxford.
I guess a good place to start is just to clarify what exactly we mean when we talk about EMI and how similar or different it is to related concepts in our field.
That's a very, very good question. Defining both is quite difficult. Let's start with EMI. The definition that I use, and I've used in my book and in a recent systematic review, is the use of the English language to teach academic subjects other than English itself in countries or jurisdictions where the first language of the majority of the population is not English. There are issues related to that definition, but what I like about the definition is that it at least raises those questions as to what exactly we mean by EMI.
Now let's talk a little bit about more globally. What are the factors that are driving this demand for EMI?
What's driving it? Well, that's quite... I think there are two drivers. One is what I call a vertical driver, where it's the pull of universities, which are, as it were, having an influence on the secondary school sector and then also on the primary school sector. So universities are wishing to internationalise. They are wanting to increase the number of their international students. And students in general are moving around the world a lot more. And obviously, English being the international lingua franca, that almost invariably imposes on a university institution the need to offer it through some of those subjects through the medium of English. Now, if you are offering courses through the medium of English to international students, that gains prestige for those particular courses. And that means that home students, the local students, also want to access those more prestigious courses. Then that, I think that has a pressure on secondary schools to respond to that, preparing students, as it were, for the academic requirements of learning through the medium of English, and therefore that has a pressure on secondary schools to teach through the medium of English. So there is a vertical pull from the universities. I think there's also what I call a horizontal pull, and that's really to do with the private sector versus the public sector, the private sector versus the state sector. So a lot of private schools, secondary schools, primary schools are advertising themselves as English-only schools. That has an effect on the state schools wishing to compete and retain high-quality students in their schools.
Yes, I think the horizontal dimension you described seems particularly relevant to South Asia, where we have, as we said earlier, this parental pressure driven by the belief that English is the language of power and an economic advantage. So just to check that I've understood correctly, that would be an example of what you mean by a horizontal pull, would it?
Yes, absolutely. Parents are thinking, well, if my child is taught through the medium of English, they will have greater advantages in a globalised world.
That leads us quite nicely onto the next question, which is to do with the evidence or the research support for EMI. It is often assumed that EMI will automatically lead to improved English, improved academic knowledge among learners. What is your take on that? What is the evidence?
Well, I think the evidence so far is thin, but that doesn't mean that the evidence doesn't exist. At the moment, I mean, looking at the systematic review that we did, which I agree is a couple of years out of date now, there hasn't been the kind of hard research evidence on whether it improves the English proficiency of the students. What we have is a lot of, as it were, reporting of beliefs about that. So you have teachers' beliefs about whether it does or whether it doesn't, and you have student beliefs whether it does and whether it doesn't.
So I think that gives us a good opportunity here to talk more generally about some of the factors, which again, from your experience, make a difference to how effective EMI actually is.
Yes, I think that if I'm going to really pinpoint two things, I would go for vocabulary as one of them and interaction as the other. So just to amplify, elaborate a bit on vocabulary, I think we in the applied linguistics field are very aware of the importance of vocabulary, the amount of vocabulary you need to adequately understand either a written text or a spoken text. And people put at around 95-96% of words in the text. And then interaction, I think in second language learning, we've all been reading and learning and arguing for greater interaction in the standard EFL or MFL classroom. But I think that applies to EMI and to CLIL as well. And if we look at all the research that's been done in science education and maths education, they all talk about the importance of interaction and scaffolding in helping students to understand what the teacher is saying or what the difficult concept that's being proposed.
Just to sum up those two points then, what you're saying is EMI will work better when students have the vocabulary they need to cope with academic input in English, is that correct?
Yep.
And it will also work better when teachers have the skill, the pedagogical skill, to make teaching and learning an interactive process.
A more interactive process.
We know that teachers need the language and having more language can help, but language without pedagogical skills is still unlikely to lead to effective EMI. Would that be correct?
Without the pedagogical skills, and particularly I've talked about vocabulary and interaction, the teacher on the one hand needs to be aware of the vocabulary that the students know and how the effect of using particular vocabulary in a particular monologue, if you like, what effect that will have, but also of the importance of scaffolding their learning.
Now, in terms of summing up, what sort of key messages are there from international work and research on EMI that it would be useful to draw to the attention of these educational policymakers in South Asia?
Well, I think what people have to do in their planning for the implementation of EMI is to do an initial cost-benefit analysis. In other words, they've got to say, okay, what are we trying to, what are going to be the potential benefits of this? Well, first of all, I would have thought that a potential benefit would have to be that there is an improved English language proficiency, because otherwise, why are you doing it? A second aspect to that is there should at least be no detrimental effect to content learning. So, there, you know, we would not want to see some kind of deficit to content learning. However, in that cost-benefit analysis, it may be that a policymaker may say, well, there may be some detrimental effect to content learning, or at least there will be some in the short term. So then the question is, how long? You know, and this has been done in Hong Kong, for example. They measured language learning. Yes, language learning, English language learning improved. However, content learning was slowed down, but it only slowed down for 2 or 3 years in the secondary school sector. So there has to be that some kind of understanding of what they're getting themselves into and what is tolerable in terms of slowing down the content learning process. So that would be a really clear message that I think has to be conveyed. I suppose the other message is, what is the impact on your first language? And of course, for very big languages like Chinese and French and Spanish, the impact will not be as high as on languages such as, I don't know, Estonian or Slovenian or whatever. But the impact might be quite heavily felt if at some point publishers stop publishing in that language for science textbooks in secondary schools or even primary schools, and they only start publishing in English, in which case there's beginning to be a death of a language there, or at least an aspect of that language. So I think there is a question that they have to ask themselves about what is the impact on the home language and indeed the home culture.
And perhaps finally, in terms of messages for policymakers, are there particular implications for the preparation of teachers when it comes to EMI?
Oh, absolutely. And of course, that entails resources. We are fairly confident from the research that long-term teacher professional development is better than a short, sharp burst. I mean, a week is probably not enough, but you need, to over a period of time get involved with self-reflection, watching yourself on video, having comments from people and so on. That's very resource heavy. So that's one thing that they would have to do, yes, professional development. And by the way, one thing I really feel quite strongly about, or increasingly strongly about, is that professional development shouldn't be delivered only by applied linguists, which is increasingly the case around the world. And somehow, again, we have to pull people together. So if you like, when you're training the trainers, you have to make sure that those trainers are combined language specialists and content specialists. I also think you can't do it by a top-down approach. So that kind of cost-benefit analysis has to involve the stakeholders. Otherwise, there will be a lack of buy-in from the EMI teachers. And then also, I think ultimately it needs to be associated with some kind of reward. It is certainly very time consuming to teach through the medium of English because you've got a plan. The planning is longer. In any case, you're switching from L1 MOI to EMI. And so some kind of either financial reward or time reward or career enhancement reward, I think is absolutely necessary.
That was Simon interviewing Professor Ernesto Macro from the University of Oxford. There's a clear link in what Janine and Ernesto were saying about drivers for EMI, and at a primary level, the research Janine mentioned should prove to be very useful in understanding better the Indian context. Somebody who has great experience in this field in advising governments on multilingual policy is Kathleen Hugh from the University of South Australia. Kathleen's done research on language education policy in southern and sub-Saharan Africa, as well as, more recently, in South Asia. For our final interview in this episode, Simon spoke to Kathleen.
The research data indicates that without a shadow of a doubt, that under the best possible and best resource conditions, students need a minimum of 6 years of mother tongue education before this can be replaced by an international language such as English. We do know that under less well-resourced conditions, students possibly may need a minimum of 8 years of mother tongue education before there can be a switch to English medium education. Perhaps I should mention here that this is based on evidence from studies collected from across sub-Saharan Africa, most recently from Ethiopia, and in several studies that I've been involved in.
So just to make sure I'm clear about the point you just mentioned, if we take a primary school setting and a decision is made by policymakers to introduce EMI, say, in the third year of primary school, what you're saying based on existing evidence is that's unlikely to be effective.
Look, the idea of 3 years of medium of instruction in the home language was an idea that UNESCO put out in 1953. In the report on, I think it was the use of the vernacular languages in education. It was an idea that perhaps that might be enough. But the 25-country study that was conducted by UNESCO and the Association for Development of Education in Africa was a study that was conducted between late 2004, early 2005, and through 2006. What that study showed us conclusively is that 3 years of home language learning with a gradual or sudden transition to English doesn't work. It's just not sufficient because students really haven't learned enough of the English language to be able to learn through the medium of the English language at that point. So they really need to have at least 6 years of learning through the mother tongue before they are ready to learn through English.
So you've explained quite clearly about the conditions that need to exist in an ideal situation. Where these conditions do exist, what are some of the main benefits of EMI for students and maybe for educational systems more generally?
Well, I would rather say that if these conditions were to exist, then one would anticipate a possibility that socioeconomic and educational inequalities may be reduced, in that higher education may become a realistic possibility for more students and a wider range of students from different linguistic and cultural contexts than is currently the case. But this is largely aspirational at this stage because, with the possible exception of one country in Africa, that is Botswana, EMI has not yet been provided in a manner that has led to such outcomes for students in mainstream education systems. Its success so far has been in the private or independent school systems for students whose parents are relatively well-to-do, professional, or from the political elite. So what I'm saying is we have very few examples of where these conditions actually do apply on a consistent basis.
Okay, that's quite clear. So I guess conversely, what are your views on the potential risks of implementing EMI in primary education when the conditions you've talked about don't exist?
Well, what we found that unless students are able to develop strong literacy in the home or local language, and to have several years of learning a second or third language to the point that they have developed academic literacy, by which I mean it's not just early reading and writing of narratives, but the kind of literacy that is required to learn academic content across the curriculum, then they are unlikely to succeed in an EMI system. In most cases, if students remain in school, the schools become more of a childcare facility with little learning taking place, or alternatively, students just simply don't keep coming to school. Now, Professor Ajit Mohanty, who's emeritus professor from Jawaharlal Nehru University, calls this pushing students out of the schooling system.
That was Kathleen Hugh speaking to Simon. Well, I'm with Simon now. Simon, we've had lots of really interesting comments on EMI in this episode, so I'm just going to try and summarise it before asking you for your thoughts. Firstly, it seems to me that the term EMI isn't really enough to describe all of this. While Janine and Kathleen spoke mainly about EMI in the context of primary education, Ernesto also mentioned its growth in higher education, obviously a very different setting. The drivers for EMI at both those extremes are clear enough. Parents want what they perceive as the best for their children. Governments want what's best for their country's growth. Universities want to attract global talent. So EMI then, it seems, is characterised by a great diversity around the world.
We've heard about EMI in very different settings which have diverse goals and do call for varying approaches. However, there are also some global messages here. One is that when done well, EMI can have positive educational and social economic benefits for students. However, another overall point we take away from the contributions of our experts is that EMI will only achieve its potential when specific facilitative conditions exist. In primary school, for example, this is sufficient literacy in the first and or second language, and of course a good basis of general English. At tertiary level, sufficient proficiency in English is required by both lecturers and students. It is clear that teachers cannot teach in a language they lack mastery in, and students cannot learn through a language they do not understand.
So it's just wrong then to assume that simply introducing EMI into early primary education is going to make an immediate and significant difference to learning outcomes, and consequently, a country's overall levels of education.
Yes, that is perhaps the key message that policymakers in South Asia can take away here. We've seen how certain countries around the world have made rash decisions about, for example, teaching primary mathematics or primary science in English, only to reverse these quite quickly in the face of negative results. At university level too, many examples of EMI exist, but questions often arise about how effective they actually are, given teachers' and students' levels of English and motivations towards using English more generally. So a key point here is that introducing EMI is a major educational decision that needs to have a clear rationale, reflect the abilities and motivations of students and staff, and be aligned with educational curricula more generally.
Okay, thanks very much, Simon. Don't forget, if you're interested in reading more about the theme from this episode, you can find related links on the same page as this recording. And if you'd like to comment on what you've heard, then do share your thoughts. You can let us know what you think on Facebook or on Twitter, using the hashtag Education South Asia. That's hashtag Education South Asia. And remember, there are plenty of other episodes to check out too, covering themes including inclusive education, educational planning, student learning outcomes, and more. You can find further information about the series with this podcast. Thanks for listening to this episode of Education in Focus South Asia. From Simon and me, goodbye.